Hi, I'm Jody Carlton, neurodiverse relationship expert, and welcome to season 4 of my podcast, Your Neurodiverse Relationship. This season, I've asked Mona Kay of the Neurodiverse Love podcast to join me as co-host to talk about some pretty personal stuff. Mona and I both help partners and couples understand how neurodiversity is impacting their relationship, and also how to navigate difficult decisions and choices. We've identified 5 key steps for assessing your relationship challenges and determining a path forward for yourself and your relationship. For some of you, this means working with your partner to gain insight and tools for communication and connection, and also figuring out strategies that work for you as a couple, even though they may be pretty non-traditional. But hey, if it works, it works. For others, it will mean recognizing if and when it's time to end your relationship. Mona and I have both been in marriages with neurodiverse partners that lasted over 2 decades. And in this podcast series, we're going to share with you how we navigated our own relationships along the way. And let's just say we didn't know what we were doing. Mona and I are going to go deep into the good, the bad, and the ugly. In order to share these deep and vulnerable memories, we both chose to record this season without video, to prevent the distraction of talking to our screens. We know you will recognize yourselves and so much of what we have to share, and our hope is that you will feel less alone and that our journeys will help you in your own neurodiverse relationship. Welcome. What will we talk about today? Mona Kay, host of the Neurodiverse Love podcast, is here with me today, and I really enjoy working with Mona. We've been on each other's podcasts, and now we're also doing a support group, Navigating Neurodiverse Relationships, that has just really exploded since we started it in November of 2023. We designed it to help people figure out what their options are, their path forward, and to just walk people through the steps of how to understand the choices they have in their difficult relationships. Ultimately, our goal is to help you get clarity on how you can save your marriage, if you can save your marriage, and what to do if you don't believe you can. For more information about the support group or to register for the next upcoming session, just visit me online at jodycarlton.com. So, Mona, thank you for being here and doing this series with me. What would you like to add?
No, I think that was great. And the only thing I would add is that the support group that Jody and I do is a mixed neurotype group. So we have people of all different types of neurotypes. They're for individuals, not for couples. And what's so interesting, I think, for both of us to see, but I don't want to talk for Jody, is that, first of all, a lot of the groups are, 40 to 50% each type of neurotype. So they're kind of split down the middle. And the challenge is that all neurotypes are experiencing, and they're different. But what is similar is the pain, the almost indescribable hurt that has gone on in these relationships because both partners didn't understand their own neurotype and the person they love's neurotype.
Yeah. And the support group has just been incredibly powerful. Every time it meets, Mona and I just usually stick around at the end and we're like, wow, because the partners on there just get so much insight from each other. And I think sometimes, there's an us versus them kind of dynamic when it comes to neurotypical versus neurodivergent. And when those partners get on the support group together and they see other neurotypes really struggling, but also really trying to figure it out and understand the relationship, it really helps people to see, this is not just about me and my pain. It's not just about neurodivergent. It's also about the motivation and willingness and investment in trying to understand. And it's just been such a powerful group. And so if you're interested, it's $25 per session. And if both of you actually want to attend, we ask that you don't attend together, but register for 2 different sessions. And that just gives you the safety of being able to just say what you need to say. And you can always leave your video off and you can participate or just listen. And we don't ever have trouble with participation. There's lots of engagement and people just also engage in the chat, but it's a great group. And if it's something you think you might benefit from, we would love to have you.
I think the only thing that I would add is that you may not be married. You may be in a long-term committed relationship and you're trying to decide whether you want to continue in that relationship. And I think for me, I want to start out by saying it was the most difficult decision that I ever had to make in my entire life to divorce my ex-husband. and we had been married 30 years. And, you know, we're going to talk about all the different things that we went through, both Jody and I. But this is not an easy process, whether you decide to stay or go. And it took me almost 2.5 years of a separation where we dated each other on and off, my ex-husband and I, before I decided that I needed to move forward on a divorce. So even though we're going to be able, Jody, to talk about this in, you know, a few different episodes, there's nothing easy about this. Nothing.
I would totally second that. And I would say, yeah, I totally agree with you that that was such a hard decision, which is one of the reasons why it took me years to make it. And we're going to talk more about how that process came to be for Mona and me through the years. It was not something that just came up just over a few months of time and then we decided to leave. Not like that at all. It was just an agonizing decision. And we both, through our work with neurodiverse couples and partners, we know that so many of you are in various stages similar to what we went through. And no one was really able to help guide us through that process as we went through it. And we're able to look back retrospectively and see where we struggled so much and where we didn't make choices that we needed to make, or we didn't even know what our choices were. So I'm going to start with giving you a brief intro to what the different stages are. We've identified the first stage is what we call triage, which if you think about going into the hospital or emergency room, the first thing they do is triage the severity of risk. They look at how dangerous the situation is, and that determines, you know, how much care you get right away. So in your relationship, something that a lot of people ignore are some of the signs, the risk factors of how much harm is actually being done to each partner, to children, to the family members, just the all parts of your life, really. So triage is something we're going to talk about today. And when we look back in our own relationships, how we either didn't triage very well at all, we really didn't assess our relationship and our choices in a way that gave us clarity about what to do. And then we want to talk about why we struggled to look at some of the risk, because I know so many of you are also struggling to look at, when I say risk, there's emotional dangers and psychological dangers and even physical dangers that can be there when a relationship is so disconnected and struggling. And sometimes those risks involve deal breakers, that things that you cannot live with or without. And that, but that's what triage is, to be able to look at those risks and assess how much harm or damage is actually being done to you, to your partner, and to everybody in the family. The second stage is what we call stopping the bleed. And here again, going back to the medical analogy, we need to triage and look at what those risks are and figure out where the most harm is being done so we can do whatever we need to do to make changes right away to prevent harm to ourselves, our partner, and to the rest of the family. Mona and I will share some more about how we even saw ourselves getting toxic in our relationships, and it's not inherently who we are as people. So when you're in this situation and things have gotten really intense and we were becoming toxic in a way that's not true to who we are, and we see this in our partner, then we first need to figure out how to stop the bleed. I also call it being in the boxing ring. So if you're in that boxing ring, you're bleeding out emotionally, psychologically, relationally. It's very hard to see your choices and to see your options. So we're going to talk about how we personally saw that process playing out for us when we look back in our relationships over time. The third step is identifying what the actual problems are. So once you've stopped the bleed, for yourself at least, sometimes stopping the bleed is hard to do for your partner, and it's something you just have to do for yourself to minimize harm to yourself. But then you really have to identify what the actual problems are and clarify what your non-negotiables are. You can't see at all while you're still in the boxing ring or while you're bleeding out. Your focus is so much on the intensity of harm that you can't really see clearly what the true underlying problems are. And when you're in that boxing ring or bleeding out, there's a high risk because you're going to stay in a state of fight or flight all the time. But once you can start to really identify the problems and see your choices and options, then you can start to figure out a path forward. And that may be with your partner, it may be without your partner, and it's not likely going to be clear at all right away. But we're going to talk you through how we went through these stages. So once you've been able to identify the actual underlying problems in your relationship, which may be related to your neurotypes, your differences, your communication style, your personality differences, differences in expectations, differences between wants and needs, parenting choice differences, just a lot of different things can be the at the root of the relationship issues. But you have to identify what those problems are first. And then once you can, stage four is being able to figure out your choices and options going forward. And you can't even look at those choices and options until you know what the true problems are. So in stage four, you start to really figure out, okay, what can I do? What's even possible to do? What is my partner willing or capable of doing? And what's realistic, what's not realistic? And then also looking at both sides of the coin in terms of to stay or to go. I tell people frequently, you can't really choose to stay unless you've looked at what it would be, you know, what it would mean to leave and vice versa. So that's stage four, is looking at those choices and options. And then stage five is when you actually figure out a path forward. It's when you start to really create a strategy for how you're going to move forward in your life. So Mona, do you want to start with triage, step one, assessing the risk and what you notice when you look back and reflect on your relationship?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm going to start at the beginning of my marriage because, you know, you forget kind of some of the things that may have been red flags or may have been challenges that you didn't work through that should have made you pause. But, you know, I have to tell folks, I was 21 when I met my ex-husband. We were 23 when we got married. So I was a child. I didn't know anything. I mean, I had my bachelor's in social work, and I think I might have been working on my master's, but that was it. And, you know, I didn't know much about, you know, relationships. So I think what's important for me is to remember that 4 years in, I wanted to divorce my husband. And I think I had forgotten about that when I decided to separate in 2016. And there are so many things that were happening at that time that I didn't assess the risk properly. And one major thing was when we first started getting serious, I told my ex-husband that I wanted to have at least one child, maybe two. And he told me he didn't want to have any. And I said, okay, well, then I'm not the right person for you. And Jody, literally within seconds, he says, well, I'll just have one. I'll have one. Mm-hmm. And I will, as long as we wait 5 years after we get married. And of course, I was 21 or 22 at the time. And I said, okay. And that should have been a red flag for me because, you know, having a child is a major, major, major life change and should be a decision that you come into willingly and you know, really want to have a child. And we ended up waiting 9 years. Because he wasn't ready. And although we both absolutely love our daughter, I don't know that he ever should have been a father. And It wasn't that he was a bad father at all. It was just, I think, you know, all the things that he had to manage, it was a little bit overwhelming. So that was an issue. Now I want to move forward to, I guess, 2015, the decision to separate. My ex had not worked for almost 8 years. And he was able-bodied. He was absolutely able to work, but he didn't. And it wasn't until I threatened him with divorce that he started looking for a job. And it took him over a year to find a job. And that should have been a major red flag when he didn't go back to work after a year or two. The fact that he was so comfortable at home and not actively looking for a job, the fact that he literally wasn't emotionally engaged in kind of raising our child. I oftentimes felt like a single parent. The fact that he couldn't make decisions and I was making so many, or he couldn't make decisions quickly enough. And I was feeling like I had to make all these decisions. And the weight of the world seemed to be on me. And I didn't triage. I just took more and more and more and more on. And I remember in my 40s, I'm 60 now, having what ended up being 2 panic attacks and having to call the ambulance for one because I thought I was having a heart attack. That's how overwhelmed I was. And if I had maybe had a therapist or a functional medicine doctor, maybe they would have looked at my whole situation and assessed some things and suggested maybe some changes about how I handled things in my relationship and life, but I didn't have that. And one of the big deal breakers for me was the fact that he did not go back to work until I threatened divorce. That was a big one.
So before I share about my relationship, I just want to reflect on a couple of things that you just said and just be clear that when we mention or refer to red flags, we're not referring to these men as being like red flags themselves as human beings. It's more about assessing the relationship, the risk of a relationship when you're in that dating and long-term relationship place. So compatibility, alignment, incompatibility, deal breakers. Are there red flags about the actual relationship? Is this actually going to be a healthy relationship? So that's where I'm coming from, Mona. And am I right that that's where you're coming from as well?
100%. And I always say, you know, the day that my ex and I stood before a judge at the courthouse getting divorced, I still was in love with him. I still loved him and I was in love with him. And I still care about him now. You know, I care about his well-being. But yeah, he is a wonderful person. He is a kind man. But there were so many things that were not compatible for us to be in a relationship that I ignored because I didn't understand the potential impact on my physical health, my mental health, my spiritual health, and his. It wasn't just me. It was him too. And our daughter too.
Yeah. So, you know, your story is so relatable to mine, and we've already talked about it a lot. And I think it's very important to look back at the beginning. And I always tell people, we look back not to stay there and live there, but to understand so that we can make choices for today and tomorrow. So when I look back, I see that I was 18 and he was 21, just like Mona. We were babies. We dated for a couple of years in college. And during that time, there were so many red flags about our compatibility. And the thing is, we really genuinely had a friendship. We really gelled and connected and had a great friendship over the course of the 2 years. You mentioned that your ex-husband had struggled with that decision about having a child. And what I saw then and even see now was my ex at the time was really struggling with even the idea of being in a relationship. And I was his first girlfriend. He was a senior in college, and I had many boyfriends at the time, so that was not an issue for me. But I was his first girlfriend, and he really struggled with what that meant, what a relationship was, and being committed to a relationship. And he just kind of had one foot out the door and one foot in the door most of the 2 years that we dated. And interestingly, I did realize that, and I did assess the risk. And even though it took me 2 years, I realized that he wasn't the right person for me, at least not at that time anyway. And we broke up and we went our separate ways. And I don't think either one of us ever expected to get back together. But we honestly had dated about a year, but then the second year was on and off because we still really genuinely enjoyed each other. But some of those red flags, difficulty with making a decision, with understanding or even speaking the language of relationship. And I was very much his special interest during that time. I did not know that term. I didn't know what that was. But looking back, I see it so clearly. And I actually hear this from a lot of people who have shared with me about their stories through the years.
I think I was my ex's too. Yeah, especially in the beginning.
And he had a script of romantic type of dating. And I mean, he'd leave flowers on the windshield of my car, wildflowers, just a lot of grand gestures that were just every girl's dream in that regard. He was just wonderful. But then he would also say and do things that were so shocking to me that were hurtful, that took me by surprise. And I remember one of the things he said to me at the time was, I mean, I was an athlete growing up. And so I was pretty athletic. And I don't know, I was probably about 125 pounds, something like that. He worked out avidly and I didn't. I preferred getting my exercise through sports and activities. And I really hated the gym and working out. And I remember saying to him one time, I was like, you know, because he kept badgering me about working out. I remember saying, you know, I feel like you're ashamed of me in some ways. And he was like, well, yeah, you talk about being fit, but you don't do anything about it to make yourself fit. So with his mindset, being fit was about actually working out at the gym. And it didn't really include like going on walks or playing tennis or other types of physical activities. And I remember at the time thinking, no, like, what? Looking back, I thought at the time he was being a jerk, and we had a huge fight over it, and it became a theme. I mean, one of the themes in our marriage that literally never went away for years, two decades. But looking back, I can see how he was being very literal in his way of thinking about exercise and fitness, and I didn't fit that mold. So to him, I wasn't following through in a way that he understood with what I was saying my values were, but it was just hurtful to me. But he wasn't in any way trying to hurt me. But things like that, those are the types of things that when I look back that I see that were very hurtful, and I didn't understand. But eventually, I did realize that this is not right for me. So we did break up. He went into the military for about 4 years. And then I had other relationships and was actually on the rebound from another pretty somewhat long-term intense relationship when he got out of the military. And I remember my mother saying to me, because we ended up seeing each other at a homecoming for college and just went out a couple of times. And my mother said to me, "Jody, old shoes fit really well." And it was because we'd been such good friends. It was just refreshing to be comfortable around somebody that, you know, we'd never had like this big fight or blow up that ended the relationship. We just kind of finally ended it when he went off into the military. And I mean, honestly, it took that for us to truly break it off, because even though I really could see that this was not working, it was hard for me to walk away. And there's a whole lot of reasons for that, too, that I want to talk about in terms of looking back and seeing red flags, even about myself. But when he came back home, it was just comfortable. And I was definitely on the rebound. And the next thing I know, we're a year in and we're dating. But then some of the same types of things started coming up, and I ignored them, or I acknowledged them and then dismissed them. So I remember one time in particular, and he was really struggling over something, kind of, I don't remember the exact topic, but he was just really struggling with something that, to me, I remember thinking to myself, I can never marry this man. And it wasn't out of judgment for him. It was just more of a, this is, I can't relate at all to the struggle he's having. I just can't relate to it at all. And that's not to say that we can't be in relationships with people that struggle with things that we can't relate to, but it was just very, very foreign to me, the mental struggle he was having with something. Mm-hmm. And yet we dated a couple of years and were engaged for a year and almost broke off the engagement a couple of times, at least. And a lot of it had to do with themes of indecision, not really being on the same page about what we wanted. I don't even know how we got through our engagement, because we just couldn't seem to communicate about what we wanted for our wedding. Even the engagement was just, I don't know. There were so many things, Mona, and so much were that we weren't on the same path with moving forward. And I wasn't pushing. Look, I mean, looking back, I can see how I pushed him harder than he was comfortable, but I wasn't like desperate to get married. I was just moving at a very, very different pace than he was comfortable with. And to be honest, you just said that your ex probably should have never been a father. I'm not sure mine should have ever gotten married. I think he would have married someone else eventually. And he did actually remarry after we divorced. But he was so not ready to be married at all when we got married. And those were just some huge red flags that in the beginning, I know I ignored. And then just even in the first year, we were in counseling first year. And to put that in perspective, we were married 19 years. The first year of marriage, we were already in counseling because there was so much. Yeah, the intensity of our disagreements was uncomfortably extreme, because once we got married and we're literally living under the same roof, which we had never lived together, we had never lived with somebody like a romantic partner. And then we got under the same roof, and his expectations and my expectations of what those roles were so different. And it's not like we hadn't talked about what we thought we wanted or what we expected. But once we got in those roles, it was just bad from the get-go. And you know, looking back, I'm pretty sure he'd say the same thing, that we never should have gotten married to each other, at least. But we just ignored the fact that he really wasn't ready to be in a relationship. The fact that there was a lot of misalignment between what he wanted, his expectations, what they were, and what mine were.
I think this is a great conversation. And, you know, when I think about it, I said that I had to make pretty much most of the decisions. I think my ex was emotionally, maybe not shut down, but disengaged a lot of times. And again, if I were to be in a relationship that was similar now, these would be deal breakers. So, you know, talking about issues that were important, I felt oftentimes like I was doing the majority of the talking. He would shut down and he would not be available when we were dating. He would be late a lot. Communication would just shut down. In those days, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have pagers. This was like, you know, the mid 80s. So it was sometimes very hard to get in touch with him. Mm-hmm. He would forget to follow through on things. And, you know, we were just so in love, if that's what you could call it, right? I mean, I thought I was in love with him after, you know, our first month of dating. And I'll tell you why, because I had never had somebody pay that much attention in such a romantic way when he was with me. You talked about the script. Our first Christmas together, he showered me with gifts, my birthday, Valentine's Day. He got me the most beautiful cards. And I also know that there were times I had to do some of the things I think that you had to do. I had to like say, that was not an appropriate thing to say. You know, that was mean, or I'd cry or whatever. And then he'd go out and he'd get me a card. Like, he didn't understand sometimes my feelings. And no matter how I explained it, it wasn't getting through. So I think now that we understand neurodiversity, we understand more about our own neurotypes and what we need in a relationship, I think we would assess these things, whether they're risks or red flags or potential red flags or yellow flags for us, but they might not be for somebody else in a relationship. These things were things, yeah. In your case, 19-year-old, in my case, 21-year-old, our 21 and 19-year-old selves didn't know how to assess risk and didn't know how to triage, but now we would. And so for the listeners thinking about all of these things that could be potential deal breakers, because you know their needs that you have, again, no matter what your neurotype is, I think it's critical for you to think through, do I need this level of emotional reciprocity? Do I need somebody who's less emotional? Do I need to be able to communicate every day? Do I need these things? I think that can be part of the triage, not so much assessing the risk as assessing what you need. And we'll talk more about that as we move forward.
Yeah. And also looking at the capacity of your partner and your own capacity too. Some autistic and ADHD neurodivergent individuals have much better capacity for communication and emotional connection than others. And when you look back, when you're triaging and assessing the risk of your relationship, no matter what stage you're in, whether it's early or you've been in it for years or you're in crisis, it's helpful to look back and look at what you're bringing to it. It's so easy to know exactly what your partner is bringing to it. And you know what, we tend to notice our partner a lot more than ourselves. But I know for me, part of my healing process has been looking back and looking at what I missed and sometimes what I intentionally ignored. And I think that's a very vital part of this triage, and this whole process is really not just focusing on what our partner is not, but also looking at what we're bringing to it in terms of our own stuff. I mean, I just want to speak to this here a second too, because I brought a lot of codependency to it, which meant that I had a lot of expectations for myself and for the relationship that were very dysfunctional and harmful. And looking back, I didn't know how to assess that risk because I didn't even know what that was. I didn't know I was codependent. But eventually I realized when I look back now, what I brought to it contributed to where we ended up, which, you know, we ended up in a very highly just toxic, dangerous type of marriage toward the end. And all of that accumulated over time, what he brought to it and what I brought to it. And then you add the layer of neurodivergence to just what we were bringing to it as two people, not just autistic or not autistic, but just two people. To get it even more specific, though, about some of the things that happened between us, there are a couple of stories that I can remember when I think back. And looking back, I can just really see the confusion that was happening between us and how problems were starting to present themselves, but we didn't know how to navigate those. We didn't know how to understand what was going on, and we ended up fighting, but not knowing really why and not having a resolution. So I'm going to share a couple of memories from early in our marriage that the details obviously are going to be different, but I think some of our listeners may be able to relate to the general theme. And so, you know, you mentioned him giving you flowers, Mona. We lived about 2 hours away from each other during our engagement. It wasn't always a long distance relationship, but just at that time. So at Christmas time that year, we had had a conversation about where we were going to go, you know, where we were going to spend our time. I was going to go up and have Christmas Eve dinner with his family, and we were going to spend some time there. And then we were going to leave and drive down to where my family was and do a Christmas Eve service, kind of like a midnight Christmas Eve service. And it was his job, we talked about it, to tell his family, particularly his mother, who was used to having her baby boy home for Christmas. He was the youngest of three. And I mean, you know, she loved me and I loved her and we were engaged, but he had assured me that he would have this conversation with her. And when you're talking about who makes all the decisions and who had to carry that burden, I really had to say, hey, you have got to talk to your mom. You need to tell her, you know, you've got to do that. His siblings had married people who were local, so this had never been an issue for the family. And of course, he was like, yeah. But of course, when the night came after dinner and I say, okay, you know, we need to get moving. And his mother just looks at me with this horrified look on her face. And I look at him and he's just staring at the floor. And I'm like, come on, dude. And yeah, I remember we got in a big fight about that because I felt very disrespected and devalued because he had not been willing to be, you know, uncomfortable knowing that his mom was going to be sad and probably a little guilt trippy about it. And so he very willingly threw me under the bus because he didn't know how to navigate that with her. And so that was one thing that I remember being something that was definitely problematic and a theme as we went through our marriage of me knowing and recognizing what some of the decisions that needed to be made and him either not knowing how to make those decisions himself or not knowing how to follow through, not being willing to follow through, even though intellectually he might agree with the decision. If it was uncomfortable for him, he sometimes didn't even know how to follow through with decisions we'd made as partners. And I honestly have to be really truthful about my own style of decision making as well. Being a very codependent person, which means I was kind of a chronic caregiver, I took it on as my role to be the one to make decisions and choices and to just make everything smooth and seamless. And it was my role to make sure everybody was okay, make sure he was okay, make sure everybody was okay. So I very willingly took on that role of decision making, but yet at the same time would feel resentful when he wouldn't participate or engage or put mental effort into those decisions. And that right there is just a very common dynamic in codependent relationships where one partner is being very, you know, willing to take charge and the other partner is very willing to give that role of being in charge to someone else. But then the resentment that comes later for having to carry such a mental load and a burden. And so that's very much part of what I brought into it and was a huge red flag for our relationship that none of the therapists that we saw ever caught that either, which kind of is shocking to me when I look back, but it was just never noticed. And so, but another story that I want to share, he was so romantic. And, you know, I got the cards and the flowers and the letters, love letters he would write to me that would just, again, be like every girl's dream. But then within 4 or 5 months of us getting married, I remember we were driving. I literally remember where we were, like driving on this rural country road. And I saw a bunch of wildflowers out in the field. And I said to him, you know, like, I was like, you know, I just realized you don't bring me flowers anymore. And he looked at me in absolute disbelief. And he just said, I didn't think you wanted flowers anymore. And then I looked back at him in utter disbelief and was like, why would you think that? And then it became an argument because then I felt devalued. He felt criticized. And we did not understand each other at all in that moment. And both of us felt hurt. And then we stepped right into the boxing ring at that moment. I think that was one of the incidents that ended up leading us into counseling, that conversation, which now, looking back, I understand that to him, flowers was a dating script. It wasn't the apology script like some men have that you mentioned, but it was a dating script. And he didn't think that that was a thing anymore once we got married. And I had no idea. I just thought, well, I got you now, so I don't need to give you flowers.
Right. He had changed the script to the marriage script or the engagement script, but hadn't told you. I think that's really, really interesting. And I'm sure that's going to resonate with a lot of folks. The other thing for me, I was thinking about this as you were talking about your ex-husband not telling his mother about the, you know, change in plans. One of the things that happened since the very beginning, my ex and I did, we dated for a year and then we lived together for a year. And I remember intuitively, Jody, knowing that I had to live with him before I moved forward on a more serious relationship. We weren't engaged when we moved in because he had never lived on his own. His mother did his laundry. His mother cooked for him. You know, I don't know what else his mother did, you know, that were activities of daily living that you would do if you were on your own. But I needed to know that he could do these things. And at first, you know, it was a lot of in-depth conversations, I think, about what needed to be done and figuring out how to share that. But one of the things I remember, this was the days of answering machines. Again, remember, we didn't have cell phones. Mm-hmm. And I remember almost every time we would get a call from anybody in his family, he wouldn't answer the phone. I mean, he never answered the phone anyway. He just wouldn't answer the phone. And I was, you know, so much an extrovert that I answered the phone all the time, you know, before even the answering machine got to it. But sometimes I think we had caller ID eventually, and he wouldn't answer the phone, and I couldn't understand it. And his relationship with his family was so different than my relationship with my family. Like, they didn't usually eat meals together, except maybe on holidays. He would get home from work and he would sit in the lounge chair and eat dinner while he was watching TV. It was just a different kind of relationship. And I couldn't understand why he didn't contact his family, why he didn't call them, why he didn't reach out to them, why he didn't make plans to see them. And I was always the one doing it. That should have been, you know, a question mark in my head. But now I understand. It had nothing to do with his love for his family. He just didn't value those kind of things, like talking on the phone, or he didn't think it was something he could engage in, I guess, after he had a long day or he had nothing to say, so he didn't answer the phone. I don't know exactly. I can't read his mind. Because it happened over and over and over again, I should have questioned it. I should have asked, you know, why don't you pick up the phone when somebody calls for you repeatedly and leaves messages on the answering machine? It should have been a red flag. But now I understand more about why it happened. But our relationship with our families were so different, and it had nothing to do with love. Nothing. Because I know he loves his family very much. He just had a different perspective.
I can see so many similarities as well with the difference between my ex's relationship with his family and mine, with my family, as what you're saying. And I actually have neurodivergence in my family, which we didn't discover until more recently. But it was still a very different dynamic between his family and mine. And now I can actually clearly see that his father is also autistic. So his family was very regimented and routined and structured. And they had their family gatherings, but it was like clockwork. It was exactly the same way every time, every year. And that was one of the reasons why when I threw the wrench into things of, oh, we're going to visit my family, everybody just like screeched to a halt. You know, it's like, wait, what? But, and you know, I wasn't the only in-law. I was the last one, but all of them were local. So their families were all right there. Whereas my family was out of town, but I didn't know how to interpret all of that at the time. And I didn't realize how problematic it was also going to be through the years, because we didn't live nearby his family after we got married. We did for about a year or two, and then ended up moving away for both of our careers. And yet he was not the one really ever to be in touch with his family or to coordinate things. Like you're saying, it was always expected that we would be there and we would see them. But we still had that theme of pretty much me carrying the load mentally and just planning wise with the family. And, you know, we did not live together. He had been in the military and was never deployed. But when I look back and think of how structured the military was for him, that was a really perfect thing for him. But then he came back home when he was discharged from the military and was living at home. And like, you know, similar to you, his mom was doing all the things, like you said. And he was so successful living by himself when he was in the military because he had everything so structured for him. He lived in an apartment by himself, but otherwise the military scheduled everything where he, you know, he showed up when he was supposed to and did what he was supposed to. I want to encourage the listeners to think back to the origins of their relationship, because I hear a lot of times so many people say, I felt like it was a bait and switch. I feel like my partner masked and tricked me. And I just really want to emphasize that I don't think that for most autistic individuals, if not all, that there's a trickery going on here. It's not that. The masking itself is a script that we all have. And I know I had my own dating script and I had my own marriage script. And even though we tried to talk about it, we still weren't getting it. We were not understanding each other. And I think it's important when you're, if you're in that space of feeling like you got tricked and it was a bait and switch, it's important for you to look back and say, okay, what were the red flags that I ignored? Mona, you mentioned how in love you were. So were we. We were madly in love. And I mean, I was crazy about him. We absolutely adored each other. It was very intense. And we just really loved each other so much and had such a close friendship. And that's truly one of the reasons why I didn't want to see the red flags.
Absolutely. Yeah, me either. And I think you've talked about that things got really toxic in the beginning. And for my ex and I think we were so physically compatible, like physically and sexually compatible. I think if that wasn't there, maybe I would not have ignored some of the red flags or the risks or the deal breakers. But that was one of the best parts of our relationship that never, ever, ever died, ever, even when we were separated. So for those folks that I know, my story isn't necessarily the most common in that area, but sometimes I think that can cloud our judgment. And I know it did mine for sure.
So let's take a minute to look back at other stages of the relationship as well. You know, we've been talking about the early stages of the relationship, but I think it's important to talk about assessing the risk in other stages of the relationship as well. Because, you know, looking back at the beginning is one thing, but there were also, I know for me, many times throughout the course of the 19 years that we were married and really 21 years together, that I just did not triage it well at all. My marriage, it wasn't actually toxic in the beginning. I want to clarify, it was really dysfunctional in the beginning, but it became toxic toward the end, where it was verbally violent. And there was even the potential for physical violence there that was scary. I was fearful by the end of my marriage. I was fearful and afraid. Toward the end, it had just gotten so intensely confrontational that it was frightening. And I don't think that at the core that either one of us are violent human beings. But over time, because we ignored the red flags, even though we tried to get help and therapists were really ill-equipped to help us and to recognize the problems, we still ignored the fact that there were some major deal breakers that were there that existed. And we just kept keeping on. We kept thinking, or I can't speak for him, but I mean, I know the conversations that we had, we kept thinking, we'll figure it out. We'd try to reboot. And I hear this a lot with couples that work with me. Things will come to a head and get really severe. And then it's almost like the volcano explodes and then you take a breath and try to start over. And then that cycle itself is so destructive. It repeats itself over and over again, but it gets worse and worse and the explosions get worse and worse. So triaging is about an ongoing process of looking at the risk, to look at basic safety needs. Is everybody emotionally and psychologically safe? It's not just about looking at what our wants and our needs and our emotional desires and wishes and wants. It's not just about looking at those things, but wherever you are in your relationship, it's important that you look at, am I actually safe? Like, am I physically safe? Is my partner physically safe? Am I getting so triggered and dysregulated from the pain of this relationship that I'm lashing out verbally, I'm throwing things, I'm hitting him or her, is my partner becoming so dysregulated that he or she's becoming violent toward the furniture or lashing out at me or the kids? You know, these types of things are not just normal parts of a marriage, and they're not okay. But when we're in a relationship that's so dysregulated and dysfunctional, we become conditioned and desensitized to it over time because it's not what we want. We don't want the relationship to end. We want it to work. We love this person. We don't want our family to be split up. I had children. I did not want them to not have a family unit, but I was refusing to really see how dangerous this relationship was becoming for him and for me and for them. And yet I knew it. I knew it in my head. I even went and spoke to an attorney around 10 years of marriage, and we were married 19. And at that time, I knew that we just didn't need to be together, but I just wouldn't give up. And he wouldn't either. He wouldn't really even address how bad it was at all. He would go to counseling and he did participate, but it was never, you know, we just didn't have counselors to walk us through assessing the risk. It involves really looking yourself in the mirror, looking your relationship in the mirror. And I do think that it oftentimes takes somebody else on the outside to help you see clearly, especially when you are in a highly antagonistic state, when you're bleeding out, it makes it hard for you to see things clearly. So when some of these major risk factors are happening, you definitely need a therapist or a friend or someone who is not going to just jump on the, you know, your spouse is a piece of crap bandwagon, but somebody who can really reflect back to you what they're seeing honestly and truthfully. And sometimes that's very hard to find. It's something that Mona and I didn't find. But there are resources out there, like our support group. So what are your thoughts on all that, Mona?
Yeah, I know. I agree. And I've said this on my podcast, on the Neurodiverse Love podcast. I, at times, was emotionally abusive. I was absolutely toxic. And so was my ex, but in different ways. So I would scream. I would yell. I don't remember ever calling him names, but I'd say, I don't understand why you can't just do this, or I don't understand why you're late again, or I don't understand, you know, why are you, or why are you always, why don't you ever, you know, those kind of definitive terms that should never be used. And I think that I was very judgmental because I couldn't understand the way he operated, that he needed time to do things. And I didn't want to give him that time because I thought, you know, you're a grown man. You need to be able to move forward a little bit quicker. You need to be able to make decisions. You need to be able to take a leadership role. And I don't think I gave my ex enough grace and space that he needed, but he didn't tell me he needed it. I do remember at the end, I think we were separated at the time. One of the things he said to me was the beginning of our separation. And he said, I need you to stop screaming at me. I wasn't screaming at him in the moment, but he said, I need you to stop screaming at me. This was the first time he had lived on his own. And I think he realized how much I dysregulated his nervous system. Whether he could say those words or not, I don't know. But he figured out, not having Mona around, I am much more calm. And of course, I was much more calm, too, because I didn't have somebody not doing things they said they were going to do. And so I wasn't screaming. Right. And I don't think I realized how much my screaming not only affected him, but affected our daughter. When I would start screaming, she would lock herself in her bedroom. She hated it. She hates conflict now. She's always hated conflict. He does, too. They're both conflict avoidant. And that's not healthy either, because if you think you're going to get into a romantic or an intimate relationship with somebody and never have conflict, you're in dream world. But what you need to understand, and I didn't, is how to resolve conflict in a loving, compassionate way, not screaming at the top of your lungs like Mona did.
And there's a difference between disagreement and aggressive, destructive fighting. And a lot of people may think, well, everybody fights, and you may go to friends, and friends a lot of times are really uncomfortable with the idea that your situation is dire. So they'll just well-meaningly say, well, you know, everybody fights. It's normal. But it's not normal. If it's toxic, like Mona's describing, and I definitely became toxic as well. My husband did. I know my ex-husband felt very judged by me. I felt very devalued and unimportant to him. I remember one of the things I used to say to him is, I don't feel like a priority to you. But he felt like I judged him constantly, and he would just shut down. And me judging him was not understanding him at all. I was judging him and was feeling very hurt. I was also super codependent, like I mentioned before, which means I went into the relationship thinking that being low maintenance was this great trait. And thank you, Dad, my narcissistic father, taught me that. So being low maintenance, meaning I put myself last to him, to the kids, and made sure they were okay before me. And yet then I turned around and accused him of not making me a priority when I was not making me a priority. And, you know, it's still uncomfortable to me. I'm still healing from codependent traits. But in my marriage, I developed tremendous resentment about how he wouldn't or couldn't make me a priority. But then I also want to go back to the whole bait and switch thing. When I look back, he was very clear about who he was. And he actually showed up as himself from the very beginning. He had the romantic script that shifted, but all these other things, these traits, he was very clear. And I saw them at times. And like I said, that one time when I said to myself, you know, I can't marry this man, I saw them, but I chose to ignore them. And so throughout the marriage, I saw the traits of him and the relationship that did not align with me. And again, I brought a lot of dysfunction to it as well. I did. It's so important along the way to assess how much conflict you're actually having in your relationship. And is that conflict becoming devastating to you, to your partner, to your children? And if the risk is very high if there is long-term emotional damage or psychological damage from these intense arguments. Screaming, that's a gateway to physical violence. Everybody's capable of being physically violent. Everybody. So when we allow the relationship to build and the tension and the distress to build, and if you start to not recognize who you are and you don't recognize what's coming out of your mouth, what you're saying and doing, that's the kind of thing that needs to throw up a red flag for you to stop and triage and assess the risk to yourself and to your partner to identify that there's something very wrong here.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I'm just going to repeat it. And that is when you don't recognize yourself. I mean, I can't exactly remember when I stopped recognizing myself in my marriage. It was probably when my daughter was maybe in the late years of middle school, beginning years of high school, which would have been somewhere around 2010. And we separated in 2016. And I think when I look at pictures of myself back then, there's absolutely no joy in my face and my eyes. You know, the smiles that I had were all fake. And again, it's not all to look at your partner and say, if they would have just done this, if they would have just changed, if they wouldn't have had so many red flags. I agree with you, Jody. It's about understanding, you know, what you need in an intimate partner relationship. And but really what you need to be whole and your authentic self, because I didn't understand nervous system dysregulation. I didn't understand, you know, that there were times that I needed to step away and calm myself because of that codependency. You know, I had seen my parents argue and fight and then make up, and my dad would take my mother out for dinner or buy her something. And I was looking for that same pattern in my marriage, and that wasn't healthy. So I think all those things that we come into our relationships with that we haven't healed, yes, being in relationship with somebody else that we care about and we love gives us an opportunity to heal those things. But when we stop recognizing ourselves, or, you know, we don't even understand why the things are coming out of our mouth that are coming out of our mouth because we're so dysregulated, that's time to say, you know, we need to stop the bleed. We need to stop it now.
Yeah, which is a perfect segue to the next step, which is stopping the bleed. So we can stop there for this episode. And in the next episode, we'll talk more about stopping the bleed. Because once you assess the risk, whether that's in one moment of clarity or you've really stopped and taken a look at your relationship and you realize that there's a lot of serious risk here, then the next step is, okay, what do you do next? Where are you bleeding out the most? And how do you stop that bleed in order to start figuring out how to repair? Is it even repairable? And so we'll talk about that on the next episode.
Awesome.
Thank you again to Mona Kay for co-hosting this very important podcast series about navigating the choices and decisions that are difficult to make in our neurodiverse relationships. For more information about the courses, programs, coaching, and groups that Mona and I both offer, you can visit my website at jodycarlton.com and Mona's website at neurodiverselove.com. Be sure to subscribe or follow to get updates about new episodes.